Today, I am going to speak about can physical trump digital object value in electronic age, which I know when you guys were writing down your top topics for this particular gathering, in that exact wording was what everybody put down. But the way I think about it is this thingy better in digital or physical form? So, you know, we all know these companies and entire industries that have been left behind by their inability to respond to technological inevitability, and there are always casualties. You know, the idea that everybody should or can survive is probably not the right one. And when I started out in publishing in the sort of early to mid-90s, there were design... I came in just as the paste-up boards were going out and desktop publishing was coming in, and I feel really fortunate because I got to see the old way that things were done, and I got to see really the birth of the new. And I saw a bunch of wonderful designers, most of whom are maybe of this category, you know, over 50, and you know, not yet ready to retire, but they couldn't make that shift from paste up to Quark, and they weren't successful enough to, they were one-person shops, and they couldn't hire somebody in to do the computer for them. And you know, it's hard to see those kinds of casualties, you know. And then there are American factory workers. So, you know, when change comes, everybody hails it as the downfall of Western civilization, from the printing press to the novel, you know, which was supposed to render us all stupid, to digital technology. And I know that you guys know all of this, but I find for me it's really helpful to keep that perspective of change being the only constant. So what's even harder than reacting to what's going on in the present is knowing what's going to happen in the future. Futurism. We don't have crystal balls, and what seems like an impossibility one day turns into an inevitability the next. This guy, oh my God, this guy. He actually, you know, proved his value in some other areas, but when he said this, I just looked at him and I was like, uh-huh. So, you know, it's really easy to, you know, look at a company like Kodak and think, well, if I had been leading Kodak, you know, these are not stupid people. You know, they just didn't bet on the right horses at the right time, and I'm sure there are other reasons as well. And, you know, the big six, are they still the big six? Is it like five? Yeah. They're not doing so well with all of this either. And I was one of those people who said, I love the feeling of physical books. I love the smell of paper. I am never, ever going digital. And, you know, I said, my library is my intellectual photo album. You know, I need to have it out there in the shelves. You know, every time I moved, my book boxes increased by 40. That is probably the last time, hopefully, I'll never say never again about technology or change. You know, I said when I was going to college, my dad offered to buy me a computer. I was like, no, this typewriter has, you know, whiteout capabilities. I will never use a computer. And then, you know, and then by the time I was using the computer center, you know, halfway into my freshman year on, you know, the Mac Classics or whatever, I was like, Dad, I'm ready for my computer. And he said, you missed your chance. The following year, my grandma bought me a computer. But and I, of course, said I would never have a cell phone. And, you know, in this, the vast improvement that is reading certain kinds of books on my Kindle was one of the key things that told me for once and for all that you cannot fight inevitable change. And like I said, never say never. I realize it's the evil empire we sell to Amazon. I know how difficult it is. I follow it. I am completely a self-loathing Amazon customer. I also believe in animal rights, and I am not a vegetarian. So someday I will live according to my values, but not yet. So I'm tired of hearing what you have to say. And I thought I'd tell you a little bit about myself and Knock Knock before diving into my, I think, brilliant but totally unoriginal ideas about transforming publishing into a post-digital juggernaut. So my background, as Colleen mentioned, is in publishing. Like I said, as desktop publishing was coming into being, these are six books that I wrote and or edited, including the Todd Oldham one at the lower left. You know, the first job that I was offered out of college that I was looking in publishing, you know, magazines, newspapers, or books. And the first, I turned down a job at Playgirl. where I would have gotten to pick the hunk of the month and write the copy for these really ridiculous spreads, you know, where the guy was like a painter on a ladder and it would be like, you know, Dick wields his brushes well kind of thing. And I still sometimes think that that would have been a really great arrow in my quiver of good stories. But the first job that I wanted, that I was offered, was at Rizzoli. And it was just an amazing time, you know. I didn't know that you could do these things on a computer. And do you guys remember SideQuest drives? Yeah. I love how, I mean, this, I totally stole this from, you know, online. Don't you love how they put the quarter up there for scale? So I had to learn Quark to enter changes into layouts. We always had these late-breaking deadlines, and a lot of our designers had day jobs as art directors at magazines. And so I would sit there with them from like 6 p.m. until 2 in the morning and watching them design on the fly. And, you know, I would say, well, why did you choose to make that asymmetrical? Or, you know, we're paying for this second ink. Why are you using it so sparingly? And they would explain to me a lot of the principles and dynamics of design. And at the same time, I mean, I was young. I was in New York. I was going to art galleries. I was going to museums. And I had always been pretty visual. My mother was a quilter. I grew up sewing. I always did arts and crafts, but I never thought of it as anything other than, you know, a slightly frivolous hobby. And I realized that I really loved not just the verbal, but the visual. And I had a lot of friends who were in theater and doing interesting things, and I would design their posters and their invitations. And finally, I stole Quark from the office on like 40 little floppy diskettes. And I fed them into my, again, Mac Classic, which was kind of like, you know, designing through a periscope because the screen was so small. And I realized I loved to write and design at the same time. So this is actually the first thing. This is the Knock Knock version. This is in the first release of Knock Knock in 2002. And, you know, because January then came after, which was 2003. But I did the original one for myself. It was the first thing I had offset printed on my own. It started a grand tradition at Knock Knock, which is basically justifying my own inadequacies. which is the fact that I have never gotten a holiday card out in November or December, and I secretly hold in contempt those who do. It's hard to imagine now because the landscape has really changed in the gift and humor and greeting card industry, but there was very little out there with personality and voice. It felt like sort of a, would you say a high point or a low point of homogenization? You know, the big boxes were just coming into their primacy, and it felt like everything had to go to the lowest common denominator. And I felt like, you know, and it felt kind of like, you know, if you used words that were more than two syllables, it wouldn't sell. And I felt like there have to be enough smart people who, and enough people who like irreverence and voice, you know, to support a little tiny company. I also felt that there was room in product for editorial. I didn't see a lot of alternative formats that were really taking, you know, substantial editorial. And I think of a lot of what we do as kind of like Easter eggs and Trojan horses. You know, Easter eggs are like the little things in video games where if you like click here, all of a sudden you get this whole new bonus world. And then Trojan horses, you probably know what those are. You know, books felt very linear to me, kind of limiting and unoriginal. And I've never been like a straight fiction writer, sometimes nonfiction, but not so straight. And I wanted to play with different lengths and different physical forms. So, for example, like the slang flashcards, which came out in our second release in fall 2003 in a slightly different format from this. We refresh formats from time to time. The research that we did on these, we actually talked to youth. We, you know, went out to the 7-Eleven parking lots in the malls, and we actually talked to them about the words that they use. And I identified friends around the country to go in their areas. I put out a call for people who knew teenagers, and you know, we started off, and we also did a lot of work online, and started off with a list of, you know, 300 slang words, whittled it down to 60, and then we had to write the definitions, you know, ourselves from scratch. And, you know, cross-reference the synonyms and the antonyms and so forth. So a lot of our product doesn't look like it has as much editorial work and research as it does. I know I'm a lapsed academic. That seems to be one of the things that Knock Knock editorial folks have in common. This was one of our first products. It's actually the only product from the original list in 2002 that remains on our list, also in a refreshed form. This is a real juggernaut for us, our pads. They're 6x9, and they have at various points comprised 25 to 35% of our total revenue, believe it or not. And again, kind of with the research, we didn't do a whole lot of research for the shit list, but... But actually, Why I Must Have Sex With You was inspired by this New York Times article that was on a huge study that had been done to determine all of the reasons why people have sex. And it broke down into five basic categories as like to get something, to da-da-da-da. And I thought this is so funny, you know, there are all these reasons and that somebody's taking the time to actually, you know, get them all down. There's a pad. These are our sticky notes, which also are major sellers. So this was on our first list, and just in the vein of things, you know, sort of made more physical, it totally flopped because it just said Wishing Kid on the cover, and people actually had the nerve to ask what that was. The wishing party talked about the anthropology of wishing. You know, it what do you wish for? It had quotes on wishing. And the idea was you would have this party, people would write down their wishes, read all the quotes, talk about them, take away a little wishbone, and the host would keep them for a year and then mail them out. So you would then see, you know, sort of, you know, but it's the segmented content. Multiple choice correspondence, which I actually wrote in Excel. I think it's the only entire, I love Excel. It included a multiple choice correspondence suicide note. So, because sometimes, you know, when you're at death's door, you just don't want to write from scratch. This series of cards, the truth about, so it was a threefold three-panel thing. So you'd, the front would say the truth about, and the truth about would be I love you, but then you'd open it, and it's an essay about the history of the holiday. So again, like trying to get all of these different kinds of content to these different formats. Our Wheels of Wisdom... it was really interesting figuring out the angle, like, yeah. So that's what the inside looks like. And talk about character count with spaces. This was very popular and led to this, which I now look upon as my magnum opus, but it's a Consumer Reports guide to religion that looks at things that really should matter to you, like annual cost, difficulty of conversion, number of new friends, accessories, afterlife promises. There's our dating kit, which includes the sexual release, which came on, you know, NCR paper, so you could each go away with a copy. Is it NCR? Is that what it's called? Whatever, sort of ditto. You know, but, like, again, this is, like, really, like, gobs of editorial content and research, you know, put into something that's dimensional and that has, you know, form factor, physical form factor. We like to put a lot of different Easter eggs into our products. This actually is one of the few times I vetoed sales. They wanted to take this off because they thought it was one of our products that could sell into more conservative places. And I'm like, but it's very wine-oriented. There's a little tagline there. Big word flashcards for kids, same kind of thing. So this is a new book of ours, Hide and Eek, and the idea is that you hold a flashlight up to the page, and the verso side of the page is just, you know, yellow flood coat. But if you hold a flashlight up to it, you can see these secret things. So again, like you can't, that can't be digital. See, these are all perfed and stuff. This is one of our recent top sellers. It's puffy. Sign in while sitting down. I mean, if you're sitting down. We were founded in 2002 by me. We're now about 35 employees. We've grown by 10 since Colleen last visited. And we're about half business and half creative. We're distributed in about 6,000 stores in the U.S., 45 countries. We self-distribute using independent commissioned reps and in international using distributors. And we have third-party fulfillment in Reno. And we move about 4 million units worth of stuff a year. That is of course, inflated by the sticky notes. We manufacture in China. Our minimum order quantities tend to range from $5,000 to $10,000, 94% wholesale, 6% direct-to-consumer, a lot of chain customers, many of which we do customized product for. And it's still under the Knock Knock brand, but they it's called promotional product because it's on end caps or on floor displays. It's in for a certain drive period of 8 to 12 weeks. It's themed family travel, back to school, holiday, that kind of thing. And they can't maintain our price points for our, what we call our signature product, which is in the catalog and in the warehouse ready to ship. So we can't undersell our other retailers in that way. And, of course, independent retailers rightly want to have, you know, special product that you can't buy at Target. And so we not only down-spec the product some, we also, you know, tailor it to the particular season or holiday or whatever. And we try to think more about what that audience is, not and always entirely successfully, but it's about 15% of our total sales. And we're going to just squeak past 11 million this year. We do about 50 SKUs a season and twice a year, so 100, and then about 200 more in the customized programs because they are programs. So we have, you know, 8 SKUs on an end cap kind of thing. One of the things that's unique about our business model in most of publishing, I think, is that all of the product in books until a couple years ago have been conceived, written, edited, designed in-house, which is what has allowed us to have a certain amount of brand recognition and continuity. It's more of a product model than it is a publishing model, but we've been able to do it with books as well. We're just starting to acquire books, which is really fun. So far, all of our books are gift books, so we're selling into the gift buyers, and they're not returnable. So, disruption and innovation. So, I'm sure you guys know these, but I love writing definitions. So disruption is, you know, often a technological change that comes into an industry and, you know, really changes the terms of the marketplace. And one of the things people often have to do in response to a disruption is they have to pivot. They have to change direction. They sometimes have to change their business model. You know, obviously the amount of jargon that digital and tech have brought is staggering and often comic or perverse and often baffling. If you've listened to the Malcolm Gladwell thing on This American Life, nobody? Okay. So, of course, what traditional publishing totally faces this. So, you know, I'm not a macro business expert, but I sat for a while, I thought for about 20 minutes and came up with this. It seems to me that businesses basically have these, you know, sort of 5 options in terms of facing disruption. You know, you can ignore it. You can decide that you're just going to totally blow out what you're doing until you can't do it anymore and then go off into the good night or, you know, wait tables. You can change completely and abruptly. You can be a moderate, which is what most of us do, you know, keep doing what we're doing but hedge bets by doing complementary things. Or you can find and polish your diamond. Which, you know, you determine what your current business has to offer that the disruption cannot offer, and you just, you know, you really maximize and celebrate that. We do a combination of 4 and 5, and this presentation is about 5. You know, ebooks are estimated to generate, as I'm sure you all know, 24.2% of industry revenue in 2013, and they're going to grow to 33.6% by 2018. I got that from a report whose name I don't remember. So to me, the polishing the diamond is if we're going to use paper, we need to justify the object value. Because paper is no longer, you know, the only or necessarily the best, you know, substrate or medium for what we do, I think it's important to say, if we're going to print this, why are we printing it? Why does it need to be on paper? And what does its being in paper offer the consumer that a digital version would not? So it's really reveling in and celebrating the object value. So in case you're a little confused by object value, a few more definitions. One of the things that, as I was looking through definitions of object value, the physical appeal of a product often before the customer knows anything about the product or how it works. You know, so it's like sumptuous debossing or, you know, like when people just respond so, you know, deeply and sort of instinctively to the beauty or quality of a product. Form factor, the physical characteristics and appeal of an object. And then use case, which is a more recent term for me that I now use to the point that, you know, if my coworkers were playing buzzword bingo, I would totally get buzzed off the, but how, where, and why somebody will be using a product or object, irrespective of its content. And with Knock Knock, I didn't start out to provide an alternative to digital editorial because, of course, in 2002, it wasn't nearly the fait accompli that it is now. I just really liked stuff. I like stuff that you can hold in your hands, that you can share physically. I like printing. I like all of the different bindery, you know, thing. I like all kinds of, like, oh my God, the varnish, the stamping, the foil, the die cutting. And I like alternative formats. And so, you know, when I want something portable and shareable or giftable and memorable, I crave object value. And I don't think our relationship to object value is going to go away anytime soon. One of the things I think about is how much Steve Jobs put into the object value of his technological products. But it's being honest about what digital is best for, so that we can maximize what paper is best for. And as a woman, this is something I have always tried to do. So one of my favorite stories about innovation and response to disruption is the story, I'm sure I'm oversimplifying it, but of the response of painting to photography. So once painters saw, you know, in the 19th century, that late 19th century, that photography could depict reality so easily, they started to think, well, what are we good for, you know? And they started to play with the painting medium. And it played a causal role in the advent of Impressionism and Cubism. And one of the reasons Cubists were interested in depicting so many angles of an object or person at once was because they'd seen multiple photographs, that multiple photographs could do that. I think it's just such a brilliant response to, you know, sort of being supplanted in one very basic way. So when I think about use case and usage, irrespective of content, I think of that a little bit as anthropology. These are the questions that I ask our team a lot, thinking about it structurally. Who's it for? Who's buying it? Why are they buying it? Where are they buying it? How are they perceiving it at point of purchase? One of the things we talk about internally a lot is when you're designing packaging or a cover, you know, they're seeing it from 10 feet away and being drawn in. There's seeing it from 4 feet away when you're standing right in front of it. There's picking it up. You know, there's flipping it over. I can't tell you how many of our designers starting out, you know, they'll design cover packaging with type so small, you know, and so non-communicative of what the thing is and so and unappealing. Why did we hire him, right? But and they'll be like, no, when you turn it over and you read the label, it'll explain everything, you know. I'm like, well, how do they get it in their hands and turn it over? So, you know, in terms of what will their activity be with it, and including whether they'll actually use it. I mean, one thing, and this doesn't speak well for environmentalism or anything, is we actually think that a lot of our pads never come out of the shrink wrap. They are given as gifts. I mean, what do you need 60 sheets of, let's say, things you must do to make me happy? Well, maybe you really do, but so it's a category that I like to think of as more than a card, less than a gift. You know, but why are people buying it? For whom, you know? And in college, I took this seminar that totally changed my way of thinking about this kind of thing. It was called The Anthropology of Television, taught by a professor named Conrad Kotak. And it was about television as an activity rather than as a medium. And like I said, it totally changed my way of thinking because as a liberal arts major, English literature and film studies, I had never thought about disregarding content and thinking entirely about structural properties. He did this fascinating study, really a landmark study about television in Brazil. And the reason why he studied Brazil was you had in the cities, you had television consumers who were as advanced as anywhere in the world, parallel to major American cities. And then you also had people in the jungles and stuff who had never even heard of or seen a TV. So he was able to look at how TV penetrated culture at these different stages. And this is sort of what he posited, you know, that at first there's this fascination with the physical object. They can want, they'll watch gray snow, you know, forever. Usually just one, you know, I don't know, one tribesman has a TV. And so it's very communal. Everybody comes together to watch the TV. And then, so it's this very uniting social kind of thing. Apparently after about 10 to 15 years, you get less complete absorption, but you're not yet demanding of content. And it's family communal rather than community communal. In stage three, television is in the majority of homes, which means that class-wise, it's socioeconomically, it's differentiating less among residents, and content becomes more important. Stage four is, you know, basically pre-second screen. It's totally saturated. We've got 500 channels with nothing on, and it's isolating. You don't just have a TV in everybody's living room. You have TVs in bedrooms as well. So even the individual family members are separate. And then I added this because when I took this class in 1992, there were not two screens. And you know, think about, you know, what TV content makers and networks are doing now in terms of the second screen, you know, like the Twitter of scandal and so forth. I actually, when I was preparing the talk, I noticed that Professor Kotak had later studied the link between television saturation and fertility in Brazil and found a negative correlation. So, of course, books were once precious, and reading was once social. I remember in Little House on the Prairie, they would all gather around as Ma would read, you know. We could see what one another were reading. I lived in New York for 6 years after I graduated from college. I love that this guy is reading Upton Sinclair's The Jungle on the subway. You know, we loaned books, we annotated books, we were judged by our bookshelves and our collections of books, and we're moving from the collective reading experience to the private reading experience, just as TV evolved in that way. And you can't see what somebody's reading. Probably the NSA can, but we can't. Leveraging off of the previous questions, you know, what is the activity of buying? What is the activity of reading? How are people interacting with your books? And what's the best medium for them? You know, and we all have a tendency to get up in arms about things that are relatively recent, and we think publishing has been like this forever. Well, publishing as we know it has really only been around since the late 19th century, and the era of desktop publishing didn't really start until 1983. We get so invested in what we determine as traditional and conventional and right, you know, and we act like things have been around forever and it's really just a blip. But the problem is it's attached to our sense of ourselves and to our livelihoods. For me, in terms of coming to the object value of inspiration of things in publishing, these were some of my inspirations. The Preppy Handbook, right? You know, I think of that as that and USA Today, which I didn't realize launched as late as 1980. I think of the USA Today sort of pie chart and sidebar revolution, where people don't have the patience to read running text. They want pre-digested nuggets. They want it divvied up and organized. Of course, desktop publishing made a lot of this possible. Griffin and Sabine, you know, is widely considered to be the first book to really, you know, bring a lot of special handwork, I mean, other than pop-up books, into books for adults. Remember how amazing that book was? When I was at Rizzoli, they had just published this John Cage project that was a metal box, a mirrored metal box with all these different things in it, which introduced me to the Fluxus movement, which includes people like Yoko Ono, John Cage, and other people. And then the best of Flair was this collection of this short-lived magazine. I mean, this thing had like die cuts and folds. Oh, it was just fantastic. And then the Running Press mini kits. So, you know, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, my mother and my aunt made beautiful handmade books and in all kinds of alternative formats, and I was doing that as well. I took classes at the Center for Book Arts and Bookbinding. I fell in love with a store that's still in New York called Printed Matter, which publishes or sells books physically made by artists, as well as additioned objects mostly related around printing, including some Fluxus boxes that I have purchased not terribly expensively. But those were all the things that were inspiring me. And now we're seeing another surge of books with physically considered formats, I think specifically in response to the ebook incursion. So you guys can just all, you know, read this from, I mean, all I really read is the New York Times. So, you know, we have these nice quotes about ways in which sort of book plus, you know, books with special formats are actually exceeding sales expectations in an age of digital. So Penguin is clearly the leader on a lot of this. They've always been design driven. And of course, they have like the most enviable backlist of all time. So they can reissue things. You know, the first is their Great Ideas series. It's debossed almost as well as a letterpress. Then there's this philosophy or something or another series, same thing. And then the Borges book has an amazing metallic cover, almost mirror-like. And then these, you know, like these different series. And they almost all have texture, which I believe is really key to people wanting to pick them up and feel them and touch them. You know, I have always had a really physical response to things that I want, to things that I like, to, you know, like I remember walking through clothing stores with my mother when I was little, and she would touch every piece of fabric as we went by, you know, and then of course I did, but I once dared her to try and walk through a Capwell's, I don't know if any of you remember Capwell's, but without touching a single article of clothing. I mean, we were there to buy like pillowcases, you know, and she couldn't do it. this cover designer has done beautiful work, a lot of the Penguin new series, and she designed the new hardcover classics. And this, to me, really kind of encapsulates what we can do in paper with books. One of Knock Knock's best-selling series is called Lines for All Occasions, and they're little. They're like, you know, 5x3 or something, and they're cloth. They're the best kind of cloth, and so soft and velvety and gold stamping. And they also, I don't know if we made up this term, I cannot remember, but one of the things we talk about a lot at Knock Knock is the flip test, meaning, did we make this up? I don't know. Meaning if a consumer picks up the book and they flip through it with their thumb, does every page look the same? What you want to give the impression of is real diversity of content and content presentation. So with, you know, these books are basically lines divided into chapters and then in subsections, and it's just printed in one color in a brown, but having both. This doesn't show any of the chapter starts or the chapter intros, but it shows the sidebars. And, you know, there is texture and diversity when you flip through it. And I believe that when you pick up, especially a gift book, and you flip through it and you just see running text, you're kind of like, ah. So I recently found this publisher I hadn't heard of before called Visual Editions. It's a London-based book publisher. That's supposed to be a video. A London-based publisher that launched in 2010. They say, we publish books, produce apps, and events that are all in some way about making great-looking stories. We champion books both on and off the screen that tell stories in a visual way, making for new kinds of reading experiences. We call it visual writing. We think there is often a disparity between beautifully produced high-end books that go for £100 a pop on the one hand and cheap mass-market paperbacks sold in airports on the other. And what we're trying to do is collapse those two extremes and make books with wonderful visual writing, beautiful production, books that are lovingly designed, designed to be read, and that those books are read by many, not just by a few. So they did this version of The Life and Opinions of Tristram Shandy, Gentleman by Lawrence Stern, which I hated in college. And it's just gorgeous. Huh. Oh, it's working. So it actually didn't come through that well. I apologize. It's my first experience putting video into a presentation. But like the end papers are just like day glow red, which is used throughout the book. The text is typeset in all these different interesting ways. The cover is just beautiful. It has some textural elements. I was just really impressed. So, you know, wherefore future paper? You know, these are my ultimate suggestions. Like I said, none of them original. You know, make it collectible. I think collectability, you know, in terms of people wanting objects, it's collectability. It's, I want to have this. I want to put it on my coffee table. I want to put it on my shelf. I want to put it on my nightstand. I want to have this object. Look at what's going on in non-bookstore outlets, you know, sort of special sales. We think a lot about merchandising at Knock Knock. And merchandising right now is in a moment where it's being done as sort of vignettes, you know, themed merchandising with different product types, including books. I mean, just look at an Anthropology table. That's with an IE, not a Y. And, you know, so could your novel or nonfiction pair well with product and special sales, you know? You know, could you show it with, you know, in your catalog if it's, let's say it's a cookbook with, you know, cookware or something, or, you know, food, or, you know, but like, you know, in a little bit of a vignette or diorama. If you don't think you're going to be able to get on a tabletop or face out, could you do a countertop POP display for a series? Thinking about Book Plus, which of course Klutz is sort of the pioneer and really the amazing performer in that, you know, which is physical objects that go with print or digital books. You know, with digital books, I think there's a real opportunity to get people on your mailing list by offering to actually send them a free object of something or another. You know, I thought it was a really great presentation about not saying I'm giving you something partial, but saying it's a free ebook. What if the ebook has, you know, a free adjunct playing cards or, I don't know, something, and you just have to write in and we'll send them to you. And it's something that fits in an envelope and you're going to give them something with a little bit of object value. I've been really watching the whole quarterly boxes trend. Do you guys know what I'm talking about with that? People subscribe to, like, they have them for kids, they have them for pets. Like, on a quarterly basis, if you subscribe, you receive a box full of stuff. It's curated, of course, because everything is curated, you know, which, of course, brings you back to, you know, Dickens and subscription literature. And then, of course, there's the flip test. I put in way too many Knock Knock products in this presentation, so please bear with me as we go. These are the things that often never come out of the wrapper. In terms of the physical and intellectual Easter eggs and how things can be accessible at a few different levels, so Take Out a Definitive History is a history of our outsourcing our food. It was actually reproduced in an anthology by the Cornell Hospitality School, which I was very proud of. As the lapsed academic, I'm always proud when it turns out that people cannot disprove what we've written. But you know, from point of purchase to brief review to in-depth examination. Actually, the resolution tracking system, this On Resolution, the On Resolution pamphlet is basically a book. And actually, this was used in a University of Texas at Austin study on diet and nutrition. You know, so again, it's a ton of content. It's all about habit formation, you know. You know, 1 week, 21 days, 1 month, 3 months, et cetera. We, at the beginning, provided a lot of content in our catalogs. Then we decided it was too much work and started just focusing on the product. We think a lot about gifts for self versus gift for other. And one of the challenges that you guys often have, I think that I don't, is that Knock Knock products are mostly giftable, whereas straight reading material is often for oneself. And one of the challenges with reading material is to give that to somebody, it feels like work. You know, if you give it to a reader, they already have gazillion books on their nightstand, and they're just adding it to the pile. And one of the challenges that we've had, since we put so much content and, like, multiple choice and things to do on our products, is, like, one of the responses we got to this greeting card organizer is people would look at it, and they would say, this is more work than just keeping my cards in a shoebox. Lesson learned. And the original... The original Traumatize Your Children in our Self-Hurt series was actually very, very long. It was a hardcover, it was chunky, and it felt, again, like too much work for a novelty gift book. few years later, we trimmed it down. We made it in a nice round-cornered paperback, and it's a bestseller for us. I mean, we've probably sold 100,000 of these. We created but never released a line of bookmarks that were about acknowledging the mixed gift of giving a book to a reader, like, you know, here, and add another one to the pile. These ones we actually did produce, and they do very well, but the idea of, you know, yes, I'm actually reading this, and so forth, you know, which we don't need for Kindle anymore. I believe that the power of hand, of the touch of hand, makes a big difference. I mean, I know it's real trendy right now to have the naive handwriting, but I do think that in a digital age. It's sort of like, you know, the arts and crafts movement in response to the Industrial Revolution, you know, and the Scottish guy. Macintosh. William Rennie Macintosh. Charles. Okay. Rennie, right? Middle name? Okay, thanks. I think what works with Knock Knock, even though, like, if I have to do another multiple choice thing, I'm going to shoot myself in the head, but they sell. So, but giving people easy ways to personalize and make the hand mark. So this book right now is just selling the bejesus out of itself. It's what we call a guided journal, and it has this acetate cover that has the little snipe at the upper left and then the you and the me. You take the acetate cover off, you fill in What I Love About Colleen by Jen. I don't think the book would be long enough, Colleen. And then you go through, and it has these prompted things. You deserve the blank award. And, having the interaction with the paper, I mean, that's what's so amazing about paper, right? You know, I saw somebody yesterday taking notes on their iPad with a stylus, and I was like, oh, I gotta get that, because, like, typing the stuff, even though I like to take notes on my digital, you know, so I think people really like that interaction. I think, as I've well established, I do love paper, so, you know, to stay in paper and physical, it is about this packaging or presenting the content in interesting ways. Think about the love of paper. How many of you crack open a book and stick your nose deeply in it and inhale, you know, right? And then get a little like, woo-hoo! How can you communicate that to the customer? And the heft, you know, between stone tablets and digital, like, it's pretty much just been paper, right? Paper became cheaper and cheaper to manufacture. We, you know, obliterated the forests, thank God. It became cheaper to manufacture overseas. Handwork became cheaper. Printing improvements, straight-to-plate desktop publishing. Suddenly we could do things more cheaply and easily than ever, which brought about these amazing things. And then, digital. So I think a lot about what I love about being a business person, which I thought I would hate. I thought it was the castor oil of doing the creative things that I wanted to do. And, of course, I was an artiste, right? You know? And, you know, I grew up in Berkeley. People in Berkeley do not become CEOs. So it's so much more creative than I ever imagined, and the strategic thinking and so forth. So, you guys know a lot more about digital distribution for small presses or big presses. You're more expert in the ins and outs of trade publishing and non-gift books and non-illustrated books than I am. I don't know the publishing or the technology solutions. I just know what I have observed and what people have told me about why Knock Knock's works on paper continue to sell. And I also know, as a lover of paper, what I'm drawn to. And there's no question that the gift marketplace is different from the trade book marketing place. And I don't have any real answers, but I have some beliefs. I do feel that if something is inevitable, what is the point of resisting and complaining? And if it is inevitable, you have to figure out how to work with it, around it, to it, you know, whether it's by yourself or getting help. And it, as we all know, sometimes feels like the publishing industry has turned into a bitch fest. And, you know, we're all snobs, so maybe it always has been. And everybody loves to say it's the downfall of Western civilization, and probably now it's Eastern, too. We don't believe, Knock Knock doesn't believe, that the only future for us is physical. We believe that one aspect of our future is in digital goods like apps, and we're thinking about how do we bring our form of social communications, which is one of the categories we're in, to something in the Evite and paperless post vein. That's what we're thinking about right now. The major issue, as usual, is how to capitalize it, the capital investment, and how to monetize it. And it's digital is tough. It's unprecedentedly fast moving. We're constantly being presented with different paradigms and different languages. As soon as you learn something, it's obsolete. We get left behind if we don't handle it well. And I don't understand a lot of it, but I love watching it develop. And I love trying to see how the mass market reacts, embraces, and rejects what unfolds. So I do believe that as publishers, most of us are more intellectual than perhaps the average business person. And part of what we bring to the table as publishing entrepreneurs and executives is our love of thought. And, you know, like I said, it's been so much more interesting to me than I ever imagined. And I think that in general, business is more fun and interesting if we engage with what's going on around us. And we think about how fascinating and dynamic it is and maintain the sense of the zeitgeist and ride it rather than trying to resist it. Maximize what we can do well rather than bemoaning what others do better or other, you know, technologies or media. And, you know, balance the pragmatism and realism that we must have as business people with positivity and optimism. I will leave you with one parting piece of advice for digital, or really more of a favor to ask. Please, no matter what you do, make digital book covers better, because they really kind of suck. Thank you.